I've never sexually assaulted anyone, not in high school, not ever.
Judge Brett Kavanaugh makes his case.
But with regard to Christine Ford, do you know her?
I may have met her. We did not travel in the same social circles. She was not a friend.
You don't remember ever being at parties with her, ever?
I do not.
The Supreme Court nominee denied any wrongdoing in an interview Monday evening with Fox News' Martha McCallum.
I'm a good person. I've led a good life. I've tried to do a lot of good for a lot of people. I am not perfect. I know that. None of us is perfect. I'm not perfect, but I've never, never done anything like this.
It was the first television interview for the nominee since allegations of sexual assault emerged earlier this month.
I am looking for a fair process, a process where I can defend my integrity and clear my name. And all I'm asking for is fairness and that I be heard in this process.
And for many Beltway insiders, a Supreme Court nominee taking to television to, well, rebuttal testimony at an upcoming hearing was unprecedented. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. Support and opposition for Kavanaugh has grown in light of a second allegation of sexual assault from his time as a Yale undergrad. So we wanted to know how women across different generations are reacting to the news.
My name is Brianna Clark, and I'm a second-year law student at Yale Law School.
This is Maria Pruitt-Conway from Orange Park, Florida. I'm a territory manager for a medical company.
Hi, my name is Nancy Murphy. I'm 53 years old from Fort Lauderdale, Florida.
A college student on the left side of politics, a Republican with issues with both parties, and Nancy, a centrist Republican, begins our conversation.
I think it feels like some kind of witch hunt that they went back to his past, like they found an old yearbook or something and are seeking people who might have come across him. And I don't know the validity of the stories that they're alleging, but it doesn't feel legitimate to me.
And Maria, I want to get your thoughts on this as well. How are you feeling right now?
So far, with what I've heard and the evidence that's been presented, I do feel like this is a situation where we really need to listen to the facts and see what's presented, because it does kind of seem like a last minute, revelation. And I think with the current climate, everybody needs to step back and weigh things out and listen, give them some credit, but make a judgment based on evidence.
And Brianna, you have actually been a part of the efforts to organize protests at Yale. Tell us a little bit about your reaction to the Kavanaugh accusations and your work on trying to organize these protests.
Sure. My reaction is that due to the fact that there are allegations, we need a full, fair, complete investigation of the allegations. And that's honestly to just be fair for everyone involved. And that's what a large part of the organizing for myself has been, is just calling for a fair investigation. Brett Kavanaugh will hold a very important position in our country for generations if he's confirmed. And because of that, we as a country deserve to have an investigation of the people that we're putting up there. And people that are potential victims of sexual assault have the right to be heard on their experiences. And that's what's motivated me to engage in organization efforts, as well as other students at the school.
Maria, you're the mother of an 18-year-old boy. I'm wondering, are you talking to him about this? Has this created a conversation between the two of you to discuss, who knows, everything from consent to more than that when it comes to sexual behavior?
Yeah, I do feel like that's the impetus for change in our country, is use it as talking points with your young sons and your daughters. You know, as they go out into the world and they engage in relationships, use it as an example of what's appropriate, what's respectful, how do you treat other people, what's appropriate, because that's how we're going to change what's happened in the past.
Nancy, you're also a parent, but you're a parent to a 14-year-old girl. What about your conversations with her? Has this situation impacted anything about that?
Yes. I mean, we've talked about this specific scenario, as well as just everything related to relationships. And my daughter is a 14-year-old in Catholic high school. So it's, she kind of looks at me like I'm crazy, like, Mom, I'm not even in that scenario yet. So why are we having this conversation? But I know at some point as she gets older, if she goes off to college, that especially when there's alcohol involved, I think that's a great influencing factor on people's decision-making and what they're doing, as well as their memory. So we've talked about those topics, yes. And like Maria said, it opens the opportunity for that conversation to happen.
And I will say, you know, I went to college in the 90s, and I feel like there was a conversation. Well, I know there was a conversation around things like date rape and consent. And, you know, we were talking about this back then. Brianna, you're currently in college. What is the conversation that's happening today among your peers about things like that?
I think the conversation is about understanding that there is a very real and serious danger in terms of creating spaces where people feel uncomfortable. People feel that they may be exposed to some type of sexual misconduct, and that involves things with date rape, that involves things at parties and things like that. And I think the conversation is trying to make sure that we don't create those spaces. And I think the conversation is just calling out behavior that in the past has been seen as okay, that we should start saying is no longer okay.
I'm wondering, you know, this is not a court of law. We are not, you know, Judge Kavanaugh is not being held to that standard, but he is, in fact, interviewing, if you will, for one of the most important jobs in the United States. So my question is, should we be holding him to the same standard as a court of law, which is innocent until proven guilty? Or is this line of questioning accurate for someone who is going to take one of the most important positions in the United States? I'll open that up to all of you.
This is Nancy. And I think that, yes, he should be held to the highest possible standard, with the caveat that things that happened 35 years ago when he was a teen himself, people, when you're a teenager, don't think the same way as you do when you're older, as you grow through maturity and you learn through experiences. And I think that there's got to be not flexibility, because again, there's right and there's wrong. And if they do something wrong, then that is wrong. But just that as people get older, they become more mature and have better thinking skills.
This is Brianna. And I think for me, this kind of comes down to three answers. One, he should be held to the highest standard. He's filling a position that has an immense amount of power, and anyone that is filling that position should be held to the highest standard in terms of investigating that person, in terms of vetting that person to make sure that they deserve to walk into a building every single day that says equal justice under law on the entrance of the steps. Secondly, I think regarding the allegations against Judge Kavanaugh himself, it's not only about the fact that if these are true, he was a teen, it's about the fact that he's categorically denying them. Therefore, if they are true, and I say that's a strong if, because I believe we should investigate, if they are true, it says something about his character that he denied that something happened. And then three, teenagers don't have the same maturity as adults, but there is right and wrong. And I don't know all of the allegations. I can't speak to any of the factual allegations, but some of the things that are coming out, I think that even a teenager should know is wrong. Or if not, we have to, and if they don't, it is our time and our moment to start letting our teenagers know, hey, there is a problem with that behavior.
I'm wondering, Nancy and or Maria, you guys have already been through college. You've already, you know, had these experiences. Did either of you feel when you listened to the testimony or to the allegations by Ford and Ramirez, do you recognize anything from your own college experiences in those allegations or your own time that you spent as an undergrad?
Yes, I mean, I do. I've used this example in discussions with friends. I mean, when I went to college in the mid-80s, and I had experiences with older men in, you know, a work situation, all where they did behave inappropriately. And I was a college student working my way through college, and I depended on the job that I had. And I didn't feel like I could say anything to anyone about the behaviors that, you know, were being exhibited towards me. And now in today's world, they look very differently even than they did to me back as a young 20-year-old woman, because even back then, well, that's just kind of what happens to you when you're a woman, you know. But I think right is right. Respectful behavior is respectful behavior. And there's no compromising that. Sexually harassing another person is not appropriate. It doesn't matter if you're, you know, white, black, rich, poor. And that's the direction they all need to head in moving forward.
And I just want to wrap by asking each of you, do you think that we need to trust women more?
I think, yes. I think we need to create a space where women feel, and other people, of other victims of sexual assault, because I recognize that all victims of sexual assault are not women. They're just overwhelmingly women. So I think our first charge is to create the space for people to feel comfortable telling their stories. And one way to do that is to trust what's coming out of people's mouths.
I agree that we should listen and we should trust women. But in this situation, I think the last minute nature of it, the waiting 35 years to report it, the spontaneity of this allegation suddenly appearing before deciding on whether or not this man is going to join the Supreme Court, that part to me, I have trouble believing.
I read something yesterday that's kind of stuck with me. I was reading an article about, you know, investigating another long-term incident, you know, something that happened a long time ago, and The writer said, you know, to end it up, a moral conscience at ease accomplishes nothing. That sticks with me because I feel like that's where we are in this country. It's time to not just sit back and say, this is what's always happened, you know, and turn a blind eye as long as you feel comfortable with where you're at. Let's question things. Let's think about things in a different way. As Brianna says, thoroughly investigate, give everybody, you know, a fair chance and their say, but don't just sit back and rest on what has been, you know, let's look to forge a new way.
Maria, Nancy, and Brianna, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for the opportunity. Everyone for being here.
That was Maria Pruitt Conway, Nancy Murphy, and Brianna Clark. And now we want to give you some space to respond. Since Brett Kavanaugh's confirmation first came under scrutiny, your calls have been pouring in.
This is Carol Varney. I'm calling from Atlantic Beach, Florida. I am an 84-year-old woman. I've been a registered Democrat for 66 years. It's kind of strange to me that the Democrats who are screaming about this don't seem to remember Ted Kennedy and Bill Clinton. What they did to women was much, much worse.
My name is Paul Spindell, and I'm calling from Westland, Oregon. For a lifetime appointment, we shouldn't be rushing this through. We should take our due diligence to really find out what kind of person this person is and make a judgment accordingly.
For some of you, the developments have changed your perspective on whether Kavanaugh deserves to be confirmed. For others, experiences in your own life are informing how you are following the story.
I thought he was very intelligent and smooth in his answers early in his interview process. Now that I know, I am sickened by how convincing he was in the beginning.
My name's Sharon from Somerville, South Carolina. I'm furious about the events that have been going on with the Kavanaugh nomination. Knowing many women that have been assaulted, I think it's insulting that Dr. Ford is being treated this way and that Mr. Kavanaugh is getting a walk.
This is B.J. Anderson from Scio, Oregon. I am an intelligent, accomplished, middle-aged white woman who was sexually assaulted twice in my 20s, once by a man and once by a woman. I told no one, and I think it's time that we let all the truth come out from all of us. And I am the parent of an 18-year-old brown-skinned daughter who will likely be sexually assaulted at least once in her life, and that enrages me. So I am horrified at the travesty of Mitch McConnell saying his mind is already made up and therefore not actually planning on hearing anything. All these things inform my reaction.
Last week on the show, we were following the hashtag on Twitter, Why I Didn't Report. So we asked if you had ever publicly shared a story of being sexually harassed or assaulted. And in call after call, so many women shared their experiences and told us why they didn't report. And this is a warning. There are several descriptors of sexual assault that could be difficult to hear for some of our listeners.
My name is Julia, and I'm from Minneapolis, Minnesota. And I had an experience in college twice where I was raped. And it took me many years before I told anyone. And then it was through intense therapy.
My name is Penelope, San Francisco. I'm 68. I had a similar experience right after college, which is when I realized that a drunk man is much stronger than I am. And if he decides he wants to do something, I don't have the strength to fend him off. But who was I supposed to tell afterwards?
My name is Joan. I'm calling from Vallejo, California. I was sexually abused by a minister in a church when I was 13 years old, and that was 73 years ago. I never told anybody, not my husband, not my best friend, nobody, until this year when all of this was coming out about the Me Too movement. So that's 73 years after the event occurred that I did not tell anyone.
And in some cases, you did report, but said you weren't taken seriously.
39 years ago, I was assaulted by my boss at work. I did actually contact authorities, and when I spoke with the DA's office, I heard laughing in the background. It was humiliating to be laughed at. So I do know why people do not come forward.
We're very grateful that you're sharing your experiences and thoughts with us, and we'd ask you to keep the calls coming. You can leave us a message at 877-8-MY-TAKE. This is Your Takeaway. President Trump addressed the United Nations General Assembly today. It was a somewhat awkward moment considering how hostile his administration has been towards the United Nations, and it got off to a rather bizarre start.
In less than 2 years, my administration has accomplished more than almost any administration in the history of our country. America's so true. Didn't expect that reaction, but that's okay.
Audible laughter in the room at that opening. The president spent most of his speech trying to market his America First policy for the other nations of the world.
I honor the right of every nation in this room to pursue its own customs, beliefs, and traditions. The United States will not tell you how to live or work or worship. We only ask that you honor our sovereignty in return.
He also doubled down on his decision to back out of the Iran nuclear deal.
We cannot allow the world's leading sponsor of terrorism to possess the planet's most dangerous weapons. We cannot allow a regime that chants death to America and that threatens Israel with annihilation to possess the means to deliver a nuclear warhead to any city on earth. Just can't do it. We ask all nations to isolate Iran's regime as long as its aggression continues.
Robin Wright is a fellow at the Woodrow Wilson Center and a contributing writer to The New Yorker, and she joined me to discuss where the United States currently stands on the global stage.
Well, there's been a distinct change under the Trump administration. For 70 years after World War II, Republican and Democratic administrations committed to different forms of multilateralism, not just through the UN, but through a series of global bodies, regional bodies that helped provide greater security through NATO, the G7 or the G20, the strongest economic alliances in the world, trade agreements that built regional blocks like NAFTA. And the Trump administration has taken a decidedly different tack. It has opted to put America first in across the board in all of its policies. And that has changed the global trend line toward global or multilateral agreements that help foster mutual interests. And the Trump administration, as we've seen over the last 2 years, has walked away from the Paris Climate Accord, from the Iranian nuclear deal, the most important or significant anyway, nuclear non-proliferation agreement in decades. And so that will be the kind of theme that will play out throughout President Trump's week in New York at the United Nations.
You mentioned America first, Robin, and I know that's something that the president has talked extensively about, and we've seen that in his policies and how that idea is beginning to shape. How has the international community responded?
I think that the international community has recognized that not much is going to change during his administration, and so it's quite interesting to watch how the world has reacted and moved on without him, whether it's Canada and Europe and Japan working on their own trade agreements to circumvent the way the United States is, whether it's imposing new tariffs or trying to renegotiate agreements such as NAFTA. China is becoming an increasing power. Countries, the five countries that did the nuclear deal and have remained loyal to it, Russia, the European Union, and China, recommitted on Monday night to the principles, and they're going to move on and not impose sanctions. So you see a beginning trend. There's kind of an illusion in the United States that whatever a president does is like a light switch, you can turn it off or on. And President Trump is actually making very profound changes in the structure of global relationships, not just of America's. And this is not something that can be reversed overnight.
And on Wednesday, President Trump has the gavel for the UN Security Council's meeting. How unusual is that? And what can we expect?
Well, the United States has the rotating presidency during this month, so it's not unusual for a president. Others have chaired sessions at the Security Council, but I think this one will be one that will discuss an issue that the rest of the world disagrees on, and that is the Iran nuclear deal. And this is where there's a disconnect, in part because the administration has not put in place Plan B. If you don't agree with the Iran nuclear deal, and there are plenty of issues that you can dispute, but it is the only option out there. What is it that you want? How are you going to get Iran to not go back to developing its nuclear program? And the rest of the world has decided they want to stick with it. There's a UN resolution that passed unanimously after the United States led the world's six major powers into this deal. And the question becomes, again, the world can sit and listen to President Trump, but what are his solutions besides trying to get Iran to do far more voluntarily with no incentives?
Well, and the president has also suggested on Twitter this morning that he has no plans to meet with Iranian President Hassan Rouhani.
Well, there have been mixed messages from this administration. The president had more than once said he was willing to meet with President Rouhani, but others in the administration have said there's no way that the Iranians have to change their behavior on a host of issues, whether it's meddling in the Middle East, its egregious human rights record, its missile tests, before the United States would engage with it again, that they wanted to see a really major change in behavior that almost amounts to regime change. And so I interviewed President Rouhani last night, and he indicated that he was willing to talk to the United States, but he said it's easier to go back to what we were 6 months ago rather than 6 years. And he said that he wasn't willing to see President Trump unless the United States was willing to accept an agreement embraced and negotiated by the previous administration.
Robin Wright is a contributing writer to The New Yorker. Robin, thanks for joining us.
Great to be with you.
When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
It's just so hard to wrap your arms around the fact that your child would do heroin.
She told me that day in the hospital, I'm not done using. And I was like, oh, hell yeah, you are.
It's not that OxyContin is particularly powerful. It's that pain is particularly confounding.
Every muscle and bone in your body hurts.
It's so important for the mental health and substance abuse issues to be treated together.
As the opioid epidemic continues to ravage the country, it's important to keep in mind who is affected by addiction. It could be the chef at the restaurant down the street, your family doctor, or even a colleague sitting right next to you. According to a 2017 survey from the National Safety Council, roughly 70% of employers reported that their businesses had been affected by prescription drug abuse. And this includes missing work, positive drug tests, accidents, and sometimes even overdoses. The same survey also found that fewer than 1 in 5 companies felt extremely well prepared to combat the opioid crisis, a low number for such a big problem. So what happens to workers who are experiencing an opioid addiction? Jenny Gold is here, and she's a senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. And her latest story for the New York Times explores opioid addictions in the workplace. Jenny, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So Jenny, in your piece, you profile Jimmy Sullivan. Who's Jimmy?
Jimmy is a construction worker in Portland, Oregon. He actually is a bricklayer, so they lay the brick that you might see on the outside of a building. It's a really manual labor job, very difficult, backbreaking work. And he became addicted to drugs quite a long time ago, originally crystal meth, but it evolved into heroin as the opioid epidemic really took over the country. And he continue to work as a construction worker throughout all of his addiction. And it got so bad that at one point in a single 6-month period, he overdosed 3 times on a job site. 3 times, which is quite a lot. He recovered each of those times, went back to work, and it was after that 3rd time that his boss finally did fire him.
And so, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, at least 217 workers died from drug and alcohol overdoses in 2016. But do we know or do we have any information on people like Jimmy who have overdosed but survived? Do we have any idea about the percentages?
We really don't. That 217 number, you know, it seems pretty low. It's increasing dramatically. It's up 32% from the year before and 25% every year since 2010. But those are just the fatalities. Often people recover, like Jimmy, who had 3 of these. We actually have no idea. What we know is sort of just the tip of the iceberg. We also don't know the number of accidents or safety issues that are caused by opioid use.
Also wondering, like, there are certain jobs that drug test and there are certain jobs that don't. Has drug testing come up at all in your reporting as a way to either mitigate this or to just penalize people who have drug issues right now?
Well, we do know from the National Safety Council survey that of the businesses they talk to, about half drug tested. But of that half, 40% aren't even testing for synthetic opioids like hydrocodone or fentanyl or, you know, most of the opioids that you sort of hear discussed in the news. So, you know, it's not like they're all doing it. Jimmy Sullivan, for example, he's in an industry where you would think there'd be a lot of drug testing, yet he was never asked to take a drug test. It's not so easy. It's possible to fake a drug test. I've talked to a couple people who had done that as well, a couple workers. You know, even if you get a positive result, and what does the company do? Some have a policy that's an automatic firing offense. But a lot of companies really need the workers that work for them. They're very valued employees or skilled workers. So one thing I tried to look at in my story was, you know, what were employers doing to, A, prevent opioid addiction, but B, deal with it if they find it or they identify it among their workers. And what I discovered was not a lot. You know, there's a lot they could be doing. They could certainly be doing a better job identifying it, and they could certainly be doing a better job offering treatment and guidance and trying to help their workers into recovery. But what I found was most of them are really turning a blind eye at this point.
I'm wondering if that's because it's expensive, number one. If you tell somebody, you know, to take a month off, for example, to do an inpatient treatment program, that the company loses the worker, and it also the insurance company or the person needing the help will have to pay for some of that. Does cost come into this? And also, is it really only focused on opioid users, or are we looking at other types of drug abuse, drug and alcohol abuse?
So, you know, opioids are the hot topic of the day. Lots of people do have an opioid addiction. It's a huge problem. It's a huge contributor to the 72,000 overdose deaths in 2017. But yes, you make an excellent point. We're not just talking about opioid use disorders. There's, you know, substance use is a problem across the board. Alcohol remains the greatest addictive substance. So that's a really good point to remember. In terms of cost, yes, it is expensive to offer treatment. However, employers are already spending a tremendous amount of money on the opioid epidemic. They just probably aren't identifying it. There was a Peterson Kaiser project that looked at how much employers were spending on opioid abuse, overdoses, and treatment. What they found was that $2.6 billion were spent by large employers in 2016. That was a ninefold increase of what they were spending 12 years earlier. So they're already paying for the crisis. Employers often are the ones who are providing health insurance, which means that if anyone gets those opioids or needs medical treatment having to do with them, that they're paying for it anyways.
What about the workers themselves? I mean, I'm sure there's a fear of being penalized. You know, addiction isn't just a one-sided issue, as I'm sure you know. There's all other sorts of issues with shame and fear. Does that play into workers not wanting to be more transparent about their drug and alcohol use with their own employers?
Absolutely. I think it would be very difficult to be transparent with your employers about your opioid use disorder, any substance use disorder. I think these are often situations where the employer is discovering it through other means. Maybe it's an obvious thing, like the worker is nodding off on the job. Maybe less obvious, they're coming in late frequently, they're missing a lot of work. There can be other signs and symptoms. And there's, you know, employers could be training managers to sort of spot and identify those things. But absolutely, there's also a hairy sort of legal issue here and a privacy issue for workers.
Which is one thing I was wondering, if does the worker's privacy then get violated if they say something to their employer and then the employer can open up an HR complaint? It just seems like it's really fraught.
It is a very fraught issue. But ultimately, you know, there are some groups that are doing more. What I found was that unions were really being much more forward-thinking about dealing with opioid use among their workers.
An important topic for sure. Jenny Gold is a senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Jenny, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
The leg irons tighten up. Each step you take, they tighten even more. So they dig it into your skin.
Frederick Clay served 38 years in prison for killing a cab driver. The Boston murder took place when he was a teenager in the late 1970s. But Clay has always maintained his innocence. And just over a year ago, his murder conviction was at last overturned. Clay is a free man now, but his experience of being incarcerated and sometimes shackled still haunts him.
You chained to other people. I feel like, I don't want to say this, but it felt like I was back in the slavery days. Now I know how the slaves felt.
This week, we're hearing stories about transitioning to life after prison. And today, we go to Chris Burrell, reporter at the New England Center for Investigative Reporting based at WGBH. For the past year, he's been following Frederick Clay's efforts to restart his life outside of prison and to get the money that the state owes him for that huge mistake.
A Superior Court judge overturned his conviction, vacated his conviction, largely based on really bad eyewitnesses. He is, back in the 70s, apparently, it was pretty common practice for police detectives to use hypnosis for eyewitnesses in criminal cases. And in the case of Fred Clay, one of the witnesses they had could ID one person, but not Fred Clay, and the police used a hypnotist, and after that procedure was done, this witness claimed that his brain functioned like a videotape, and he could rewind it and then say, yes, I believe Fred Clay was the man who climbed into a taxi cab in Boston in 1979.
So we're exploring what happens when someone is released from prison, especially those initial days and weeks. What have been some of the challenges that Clay has faced with his own reentry in life outside of prison?
Well, I think it helps for people to imagine something. Imagine you had just turned 16 and you were taken from your home and put in prison for almost 40 years. You would have missed, you know, all of that, those experiences of your, you know, most of your teenage years. You would have missed high school and anything that happened after that, the rest of your adulthood spent behind bars. And then you're released. And what, how do you survive? How do you get a job? How do you find shelter? And those were the chief challenges I watched Fred Clay deal with.
How people maintain their sanity, dealing with all this craziness that I have to deal with. It's not easy. All the stuff I'm trying to learn now, I should have learned a long time ago. Or at least I should have some better knowledge of what I'm doing. I just feel sad about a lot of things I missed out on.
His conviction was vacated, but if he goes to apply for a job and a employer, you know, you have to answer questions on a job application, employer decides to check for a criminal record, they're going to see that he was arrested for murder. And they might see a little notation that says conviction was overturned, but, you know, the fact is they're going to see a serious criminal record show up. So his record is not expunged yet. That's a process that's going to potentially take place. But it's largely the basic building blocks of survival. He doesn't know how to drive, for instance. He lives in a city, a small city north of Boston, where public transit shuts down around 7:30 at night, which really limits what, you know, what kind of jobs he can get. He has to largely walk to work.
We talk about some of the physical obstacles or the physical actual shackles that Clay has worn, but you also talk about invisible shackles. What are some of those?
In that scheme of survival, I mean, you know, in terms of housing, look at this, you know, he's doesn't make that much money, has a low wage job now. The first housing he was able to get was in a sober house, but he doesn't have addiction problems. But that was the only housing he could find, was a bedroom in this kind of setting, which means, you know, he had to submit urine tests. Police were frequently coming into this building. When he got to a better place, the only place he could find was literally a bedroom in a basement. With a tiny window, no kitchen, just a microwave. And then there's the state bureaucracy that, you know, on paper, the law says that people like him should be getting compensation. They should be getting something that was newly added to the state law, which is immediate relief, which could be a housing subsidy, could be job training. None of that's come through for him in the last year, largely because of bureaucratic, you know, red tape.
And there's also some things that are triggers for Clay. Can you tell us a little bit about those?
Yeah. You know, I was talking to him in June. It was the evening time, and he was talking about there was things he likes to do in the evening. But again, there's no bus service in the city of Lowell. And he talked about sometimes having to take a taxi cab or an Uber and just how much this petrifies him. He was convicted of murdering a cab driver. So when he gets into a cab, he's really scared that, you know, it just brings up all these memories of this awful, tragic thing that happened to him.
When I got in the cab, I started wiping down everything. My fingerprints, everything. I didn't, like, as soon as I step out this cab, they're going to try to arrest me for something else or related to this cab. I was real, real scared.
I'm wondering if he and other folks who are getting out of prison, are they eligible for mental health? Because this seems like it's not just the crime, but it's a long trauma from the crime and from the experience of being incarcerated.
Well, actually, he's not. I mean, this falls into, at least in Massachusetts, a bit of a catch-22 because his conviction was vacated. He's not paroled. He's not eligible for those services. Had he been paroled, he would have been in a pipeline for some reentry services offered by the state, which would have included a social worker. So he doesn't have access to those.
Your reporting has also shown that he's up for, now I just want to make sure we have this right, $1 million in compensation from the state?
That's correct. Many states have compensation laws. About 33 states have compensation laws for people who are wrongly convicted. In Massachusetts, there's a cap. Some states don't have caps. Some states have formulas that say you'll get X amount of money per year that you were wrongly imprisoned. In Massachusetts, the cap was $500,000. Now it's $1 million. So, but the problem here in Massachusetts is that the bar to receive that compensation is really high. He has to prove by clear and convincing evidence that he's innocent.
Is that fair?
A lot of people say it's not. And I even had an interview with the state attorney general who, in the interview, is starting to question that bar and would like to see more changes made to the statute here in Massachusetts.
They made me pay for someone else's mistakes all these years. So why can't they just admit that they made a mistake and just not fight it? Okay, you deserve something. So here we go.
I mean, I have to agree here with Clay that this just seems an egregious way to continue to hurt somebody.
Right. I mean, it feels like an injustice on top of a huge injustice. And he puts it very well. You know, it's the state that made this really huge mistake. And here he is, you know, more than a year out, still trying to make a go of it and not having, you know, $1 million isn't that much given the fact that he was in 38 years. That translates to about $26,000 a year for each year he was imprisoned, which is very low on the scheme of things nationally, would rate or rank Massachusetts at a very low ranking.
And where do we see him going from here in his case?
Well, I don't know. We've watched at the New England Center for Investigative Reporting, we've watched other cases, and in some cases, the Attorney General's office fights these very hard, sometimes going to an actual trial. So it can take months or years to actually get the compensation. I would hope that Fred Clay's attorneys can work out a settlement with the Attorney General and he could get help much more quickly than having to wait months and years. Meanwhile, if you ask him about it, he tries not to think about the compensation. He wants to get a better job. He wants to get into a healthy relationship with somebody, and he wants to have a better place to live than a basement.
Chris Burrell is a reporter with WGBH's news partner, the New England Center for Investigative Reporting in Boston. And you'll find a link to his series about Frederick Clay, which is airing this week at thetakeaway.org. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. Go ahead and check Tuesday off of this crazy news week. Thanks so much for being with us. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. See you tomorrow.